Welcome to the Collector's Show this week. I'm Harold Nickel here on Web Talk Radio. You may guess from my deeper voice that it is indeed the cold and flu season here in Southeast Texas. And we had lived here, and actually grew up here, my wife and I both, and had always planned to move back. We lived in Michigan for a number of years, those of you who used to listen to the old version of the show, and then lived in Maryland and came back here to be close to family and friends, just like we always planned. What I don't think either of us really remembered was it rains all the time. Now, they had a drought here, but apparently the drought is broken, so all of the rain leads to the cold and flu season, which leads to the mosquito season, which I'm guessing is going to ultimately lead to the malaria season. You can go home again, but it's not going to be the way you remembered it. That's just my advice. I may be looking for a quinine water collector with that malaria thing. Anyway, enough of my foolishness. This week on the show, we're going to be talking with Dirk Van Turnhout from the Houston Museum of Natural Science. He's the curator of anthropology, and he's going to describe for us how and where visitors to the museum can see things that are not on display. You get a real-life, actual, backstage look at collections at the Houston Museum of Natural Science, one of which is of Plains Indians artifacts that were collected by an individual and then bequeathed to the museum. It's a very interesting story, and I think one that individual collectors will be able to relate to. And then later in the program, our friend Larry Zale is going to talk about the need for estate, or what he calls legacy planning, for collections. And that ties in very nicely with the story of the collector from the Houston Museum, a man whose name was Gordon Smith. And you'll hear about that and be able to connect those dots by listening to the rest of the program. Have you watched that show, Storage Wars, A&E's Storage Wars and Texas Storage Wars? Well, it turns out that abandoned storage units are not just for treasure hunters, that criminals are finding them and have been finding them to be great places to stash illegal stuff, stolen items, and even bodies and movie props. Storage units have become convenient depositories to stash unusual, unwanted, and illegal stuff. Last year, in a unit in Clearwater, Florida, there was a handmade blue-painted coffin with a 95-year-old woman inside of it, whom relatives thought had been buried 17 years before. The woman's daughter described in the Tampa Bay Times as a classic hoarder, chose to place her mother in a rental unit instead of a traditional cemetery. James Bond's submarine car, which was a Lotus Esprit from 1977's The Spy Who Loved Me, was sold at an auction in London. The consigner had found it under blankets in a Long Island, New York storage container. Of course, a freezer in Ventura, California, in a storage unit there, kept the body of a man missing for 2 years until it was discovered last summer. A man who bought the contents of a Pensacola, Florida storage unit found preserved human brains, hearts, and lungs. The previous renter had been the city's medical examiner until 2003. There's a place in Michigan, Ypsilanti, Michigan, and that is the National Storage Center, and they advise winning bidders who discover illegal materials to call the police and not take anything out if you find anything weird or illegal. Now, something a little more pleasant. There's a collector who tries to reunite orphaned photos with his families. He's a man, Robert D. King. He's a 61-year-old geotechnical engineer, and he has spent thousands of hours combing antique shops, flea markets, and the internet in his quest to reunite antique orphan photographs and their families. He collects only photographs that have names, dates, or places on them, and that includes tintypes, daguerreotypes, whatever those are, cabinet carts, carte de vistes, personal picture postcards, photo albums, and yearbooks. He then catalogs each one and posts the surname or other pertinent information on his website. He doesn't charge for his service. He just wants his expenses reimbursed, which is a nominal fee for photos he purchased. So he's just reimbursing himself. If you want to go see if some of your missing photos are there, his website is, and this is one word, Four Kings, and it's FourKings.freeyellow.com. That's kind of neat, reuniting people with their past. Pez Collectors News has been bringing Pez Collectors the latest Pez collecting hobby information since 1995. They have a new 40-page pictorial guide and checklist that will help Pez dispenser collectors identify and see which of the new Pez dispensers that they are missing. They have almost 500 dispensers pictured. You can get that off of Amazon. In our new collectible department, Plants vs. Zombies, Gaming Heads is proud to announce and introduce to you the classic zombie from the hit game Plants vs. Zombies. Captured in PopCap signature style, this zombie figurine stands on a tile of grass from the game, slowly but surely trying to make his way towards another home to invade. Another board game, card game, pop culture thing that has collectible items to accompany it. It retails for $149. So, save your money. Walt Disney is switching from collectible paper stock certificates to electronic no paper stock certificates. And for those of you who may not know, Disney printed their stock certificates on paper that had Mickey Mouse and Bambi and Dumbo and Cinderella, and they've decided not to do that anymore. They cite the cost of printing those kinds of stock certificates and are just doing it electronically. I'll bet those become collectible very soon. I, for one, don't base my stock picks on the characters on the certificate, but what do I know? Upper Deck is going to release trading cards, games, and stickers inspired by popular 20th Century Fox franchises, and those are going to include Alien, a deck-building game, which features Alien from the Alien movie. I don't know if these are going to be worthwhile collectibles or not, but I suggest you check out Upper Deck, their website, to see if they have things coming out that you would aspire to. Okay, that's it for the news. That's it for my health and weather update. Coming up, the Houston Museum of Natural Science curator and anthropologist Dirk Van Turenhout, all on the Collector Show here on Web Talk Radio.
It's the interview segment of the Collector's Show. Now, we talk to people who have different interests and different types of collecting. We're very fortunate to be joined this week by Dirk Van Turenhout. He's a PhD, and he is the curator of anthropology at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. Now, one of the things that we're going to talk about today is a very popular and new type of display, I guess, for lack of a better term. And Dirk Van Turenhout, welcome to the Collector Show.
A pleasure to be with you. How are you?
I'm great. And you don't mind if I call you Dirk, do you?
No, please do.
Okay. So, as curator, you didn't just start out with that as your job. How would you describe yourself in terms of becoming interested in a topic like anthropology?
I think the answer in my case is one that a lot of people could give, and that is if you end up in a place where you count yourself fortunate that you are doing what you love, usually there is a teacher somewhere down the line who prodded you or sparked some interest in you, and that is certainly true for me, and I'm sure for others too. In my case, it was a teacher back in Belgium, where I'm from, in sixth grade, who really had a knack of conveying what was life like in my hometown back in Belgium over the thousands of years of the history that city went back. And so he asked us students when we were about 12 years old to go to various churches, museums. He gave us questions to answer and to get answers to. And I really thoroughly enjoyed that. And so much so that when I went from what we call primary school up to age 12 into what we call secondary school, sort of high school if you want, I wanted to continue learning more about things that were ancient. So I ended up studying Latin and Greek, and I continued doing that at the university back in Belgium, where I got a degree in archaeology and in history. And then at one point, I was listening to the radio, and I heard somebody announce a lecture series about a culture really far away, a culture called the Maya, people in Mexico and Guatemala, and there was going to be a slideshow. And I thought, that sounds interesting, but the kicker was it was in my hometown, so it was easy to get to.
Yeah, that's how I have made a lot of decisions in my life. Can I get there from here?
Exactly, right? And so it was not easy to get from Belgium to Guatemala, but for a lecture in my hometown about Guatemala, sure, I could do that. And so I ended up going, and I got really interested in these totally different civilizations on this side of the ocean who independently developed, evolved, did things that were semi-similar. They built pyramids, they built cities, but in their own way. And so ultimately, I looked into studying more what these cultures were all about, and I was very lucky to be able to come to the United States. And I went to a university in New Orleans called Tulane
Sure.
University. And they have a very good program in, among other things, pre-Columbian archaeology. And so I did go to Tulane. I got my doctorate over there working on Maya archaeology. And as you said, life, you know, takes you different places that, without you realizing it, how you get there. But I was lucky to become aware at one point of an opening here at the museum, and I applied, and lucky that I also got the job.
Yeah, Dirk and I were talking before the program, and I'm a fifth-generation Texan, and although I haven't lived there in some time, I'm from Houston, and I could hear from Dirk's accent that I didn't think he was from Southeast Texas. So, but like you say,
no, I got here as you know, many people say, I got here as soon as I could.
Absolutely.
So I hope that still counts.
You chose to be a Texan, and that counts.
Absolutely.
Double.
And glad to be here.
So, when we talk about anthropology and the places you were interested in visiting growing up, churches and museums, those are places where big collections of different types of things are housed. And I want to fast forward to the Houston Museum of Natural Science, because you guys have been collecting things for well over a century, but so many of them have never been available for the public to see, and you've started something called an off-site tour, and there are many different things that are collected and cataloged in those. Give us an overview of the off-site collections tours.
Well, for starters, you are correct. Just about any museum tends to have a whole lot more items, let's call them, that are in the collection, are part of the museum's collections that are not on display. Now, over the years, things get rotated in and out. And in some cases, for example, our dinosaur collection, if you can call it, most of those guys are actually on display because it would take up an awful lot of space to house and store a dinosaur that is not on display. So most of those are actually visible. But then, for example, for anthropology or shells or malacology, as we call it, we have an awful lot more things that are not currently on display and housed and stored in a safe place here in our storage facility. So what we have started recently is to provide an opportunity to small groups of people to come visit sort of behind the scenes, if you want. These are tours with about a dozen visitors that are given an opportunity to come visit a section that is part of the museum where we house and store and maintain and protect our objects and or, say, animals that are prepared for exhibit that are currently not on display. So what you get to see is what we do before something becomes an exhibit. Most people don't get to see that because an exhibit goes up, it stays up for 6 months, a year, 2 years, depending, and then it disappears, and a few weeks later, maybe a month later, in the same space, there is a new exhibit, and it's almost like you blink an eye, and, oh, it's gone, and something new appears. But the magic happens here, if you want. This is where we prep exhibits, and eventually they will go up at the museum. We have two venues, as you know. We have the main campus in Herman Park, and we have a fairly new, it's about 4 years old, I think, venue in Sugarland in the old prison building.
Oh, wow. And for people not familiar with the Houston area, one of those locations, the first one, the main, the Herman Park address, is just south of downtown Houston, and then the Sugar Land area is out in southwest Houston, but both are very easy to get to if you're thinking about visiting. So for these collections, it sounds like it's a backstage look at things that you guys have curated and have under your protection, for lack of a better way of saying it, that people wouldn't ordinarily get to see. But if they're ordinarily not available for viewing, how do I get a good look?
Well, I'll give you an example. We have a collection of North American Indian artifacts, a lot of it clothing and some other artifacts that people use for hunting purposes, for example, that came to us a few years ago, and it's a very large collection of Plains Indian material.
Mm-hmm.
So we have had an exhibit that was a temporary exhibit for about 6 months, and it was a selection of that collection. So people were able to see it for a while, not all of it, and it wasn't permanent. It went back into storage. So what you will see here is the entire collection, and you will see how we store things. You can imagine that for every single type of item, there are different ways in which we store things, depending on, of course, the size, depending on the requirements. But in general, you have cabinets, you have shelving units, you have all kinds of open spaces where larger items are stored in an environment where we control the humidity, you control the climate, you control the temperature. As you know, here in Houston, it gets to be hot and humid
an awful
lot, but that's not a good thing for artifacts. So we lower the temperature, maintain the same type of about 50% humidity, and we always, as much as possible, when we are not in the areas where these artifacts are stored, the lights go out because light is damaging.
Yeah, we've talked before, and honestly, Dirk, we've talked at great length about not just heat, light, dust, but of the thing that you as an anthropologist do, you and your colleagues at the Houston Museum of Natural Science, and that's to catalog and write down what's there.
Oh, we have lots and lots of artifacts, and currently the same collection, for example, is being prepared. A selection, again, is being prepared for display in Fort Worth. So we are working with the data we receive and additional data we are collecting through literature research about the artifacts, about the tribes, about and the notes that the collector took to weave a story together that will be going up as part of the exhibit in Fort Worth, but also as part of a web-based virtual exhibit that people, no matter where they are, can see. So it's a combination of both, and that way a little bit of that veil, if you want, is lifted. It is not an easy thing to do, and you're right in your assessment that there's a lot here that you will only get to see if you were to take a tour, because otherwise it might take a few years before something will actually get rotated into being displayed at the museum.
Yeah,
we do try to do that, but it takes time.
Sure. I'm interested, something that you said just a moment ago, you were trying to tell the story that the collector had in mind. So is it fair for me to assume that the things you're going to be working with and showing in Fort Worth and online, that came from an individual?
Yes, in this particular case, that came from a particular individual. His name was Gordon Smith, and he collected these Plains Indian materials in the years, 10, 15 years preceding World War II. He got started at a very young age, got interested, and he collected. And the interesting thing here is he collected by going to the individuals who were members of the tribes. He did not purchase from antique stores or something. He actually went to the people. His family took vacations up north, and so he was able to actually ask those people who made the objects what these things were all about, what they used them for, how did they make them. And so he wrote a book. It hasn't been published yet. But there are plans within the family. Unfortunately, Mr. Gordon passed away, but there are plans in the family to have the book published. But we have the notes. So we have almost like an interview, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
This is a particular object that was made by a particular Plains Indian tribe, and we get it courtesy of the collector, the words of the person who made that object. So what was that all about? And as you know, once you get farther and farther removed from the object and the person who made it, some of the story tends to get lost.
That's right.
And in this case, we are right there, up to the source, and that is really cool.
So it's a three-dimensional, almost slice or snapshot of what life was like for the Plains Indians as told by those people.
Correct.
And as made by those people.
Correct, yes.
That's so.
And that is rare.
Yeah, that's so much better. You know, nothing against history books, because I read them routinely. But that takes collecting from something that you can read about to something that you really experience, and I think that's what people are going to get out of the Houston Museum.
That's right, yes. And we don't control that. It depends from one collection to another, but we count ourselves very lucky in this case to have that type of information.
And for people who listen to this show and are serious about their collections, it's that kind of documentation that helps to separate a serious or significant collection from one that's not as interesting.
That's a very good point to make. For anybody who does collect, it is so important to make notes as to where you got things, where you found things. And in this case, if it's man-made, if it's a mineral, it's one thing. But if it's a man-made object, maybe, you know, not maybe, but for sure, write down who you got it from or who made it and what the stories are, because a lot of times, and this is a very human reaction, mm-hmm. you always sort of procrastinate, right? And we'll write it down later, and I will remember. But eventually the time comes when we all disappear.
Oh, sure.
And so if there are no notes, the next generation will go, well, we kind of identify this as belonging to this particular time period and this particular culture, but beyond that, the story is lost. You once knew it, but you need to share it.
And there's no substitute for just writing it down.
No, you're right.
The thing that has troubled me in the stories we've heard, and that not all of them have gotten on the air, but tales of people who have discovered a closet full of something that one of their forebears had collected, but their heirs had no idea what it was and threw it away.
Yes.
And that's everything from... And everybody's mother did this, threw away their baseball cards and their comic books,
yep.
to rare manuscripts and works of art. So, Gordon Smith, thank you wherever you are.
Yes, indeed. I would echo that sentiment, yes.
Let's talk about the things in the off-site tour that have surprised you at their popularity. What's the thing that people gravitate to?
Well, there are, in our anthropology collection, and this, I know I'm biased, but there is a very large, very beautiful, very colorful collection of Amazonian Indian materials. There are, most of those, there are objects made out of, or with feathers. Mm-hmm. Imagine macaws and all kinds of very colorful feathers that are turned into works of art, which at the same time were very utilitarian. They were used for a purpose. There were masks, headdresses, arm and leg ornaments that these people have used in the past and continue to use until today, but even there the cultures are disappearing. And that is a collection which is fairly large, 3,500 pieces and counting, but also one of the largest in the world. Berlin, there's a museum in Berlin that has a larger collection, but we're right up there, I would say, in the top five for sure.
Wow.
And that is something when you talk to people, these are not antiquities, mind you. They are between 50 to 75 years old, maybe here and there a few that are 100 years old. However, this is very fragile material. And so look around in your own house. You have something that is made out of ceramic, your coffee mug, and then there's glass, and then there's your computer, which is plastic, and imagine 50 years, 100 years from now, what will have been preserved and what will have been thrown out. Think baseball cards, like you mentioned.
Right. So
some of these things will disappear. And the same thing for the Amazonian tribes. When they are done with ceremonies, in some cases they will get rid of the outfits that they made, the masks, the costumes, the headgear. And in the rainforest, it doesn't take long before it disappears.
Well, and
we were lucky to have that preserved, and now we turn that into a story. and we can display it.
And you,
very ephemeral.
Yeah, you read my mind, because the thing I was going to ask you about with respect to feathers, and, you know, it's hot and humid in Houston, but that's nothing compared to the Amazon jungle, is how something that was that fragile was preserved.
Right.
But it sounds intriguing. Is there anything you think a new collector, somebody who's thinking about starting a collection, and it doesn't matter what it is, what would they learn at your off-site tour?
Well, we do highlight what you already brought up, which is the importance of whatever it is you may be collecting, is not just the item, the tangible object that you have in your hand and have at your home, but also the context information, for starters. What is this? Where, when, what, all those questions that would be good to be able to answer. And so that's a start, if you want. And then the other information that people will be able to gather or ask questions about is, how do I take care of whatever it is that I am collecting? If you're into, for example, collecting lithics or arrowheads, it would be good, and typically I know that your listeners are more advanced than this, but a lot of people tend still to bring grandpa's collection of arrowheads in the old-fashioned cigar boxes.
Or a shoebox.
Yes, and exactly. And that's not a good thing for the stone tools. That is not a good thing, because they are rubbing against each other, they break. That's not how you want to take care of things. So we can show you, and we can tell you how, for example, it would be better to have these preserved in various ways. There are less expensive and more expensive ways, but people can ask questions. And if it's not explained fully during the tour, you can ask questions, and we'll try to help you, give you answers. So it's the what we call the care and feeding of these artifacts, of these objects. If you're into, I don't know, butterflies, for example, it's a totally different subject altogether, but we have a very large collection. We have a butterfly center at the museum, and eventually, of course, the butterflies do pass away, and not every single one is preserved, but we have a very large, very extensive collection of butterflies and moths and insects. So if people are into that kind of collecting, there are ways to what we call spread their wings and preserve them properly. And that is a labor of love and patience. And we have people who can explain how that is done. And we can get you more information afterwards as well. So it's a learning experience. It should be an enjoyable experience. And I'm sure people who come are coming because they are interested in the subject matter and looking forward to seeing what we have, but also, as you said, learn more about how to do things right, especially if you're starting out.
Absolutely. Now, one thing, and I'll share this with you and with the listeners, I wanted to go. I knew we were going to do this interview, so I tried to get in on one of these tours.
Mm.
It's just about impossible. They're very, very popular. How many weeks out do you have to go?
I honestly don't know. I haven't checked, but it's not like on a daily basis, you can imagine, because our section is not open to the public on a daily basis. We have occasional visitors, for sure. We have students who come and work as interns, and there is that. But otherwise, bringing in groups of 12 people tends to be, if you do it on a daily basis, it tends to eat up time and resources, if you want.
Sure.
Nothing against it, but that's just the reality.
Sure.
So we started this fairly recently, so I haven't checked. We are doing this, I think, once a month. And we are not doing it during the summer. Now, we just started, so we haven't done this. There hasn't been a summer yet. So we do two tours a month on one particular day. And that should be available through our museum website.
Right.
But I haven't honestly checked to see. You got me there.
Sorry.
How far out one would have to book to be able to visit.
All I can suggest to people who are listening who are interested in going is don't wait. Go to the Houston Museum of Natural Science website and make your reservation, because if you're Mr. Last Minute like I am on everything, you're not gonna be able to get in. Dirk Van Turenhout, Ph.D., the curator of anthropology at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. Hey, thank you for being on the Collector Show today.
My pleasure, and I hope that one day you will make it. And I look forward to meeting you in person.
I think you can count on it.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Stay tuned to Web Talk Radio. More in a moment. I'm Harold Nickel. Well, it's time on the Collector's Show for us to talk with our friend Lawrence C. Zale, who's nice enough to let us call him Larry. Larry has a tremendous amount of expertise in all things collectible, particularly recognizing and helping people build meaningful collections and helping them plan for the future of those collections once they have left this earthly veil of tears. And Larry, welcome back to the Collector Show.
Harold, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, last week we talked about, I guess it was part one of estate planning, and it's a complex enough topic that we felt like it deserved a part two. And the positioning of the message that you've brought to us is legacy planning, and I'm intrigued by the choice of the word legacy because it implies that something that lives on after the collector. Is that a fair conclusion?
It can also be done during one's lifetime, but the legacy presumes that there will be part of the collector in the collection in some way, whether the collection stays whole or in part, and it may also include cash as an endowment in certain instances.
And I think that the one thing that I took away, well, I took away more than just one, but one of the more important lessons that I learned from what you shared with us last week is that you can't just rely on your heirs or your executor to move forward or know what it is you have in mind for your collection unless you give them some pretty specific instructions.
Yes, I think it's really incumbent upon collectors to have this conversation with their family and loved ones. Unlike other assets, it tends not to be discussed, and I would urge them in the strongest terms possible to do so to avoid misunderstandings during their lifetime or as part of their estate. And in that conversation, things about the works, if the children share the enthusiasm that the collector or perhaps together with his or her spouse, then arrangements could be made to pass on the collection when they pass on. There are instances, and I would say probably more often than not, when the heirs do not share the enthusiasm that the collectors have for their collections, and therefore it really is incumbent upon them is to plan ahead to make sure that the collection, if their intention is to keep it whole or at least a significant part, it finds a home or buyers that would keep it whole, and then the proceeds that come from such an arrangement would either be offset by a sale or some form of tax avoidance as part of the estate.
Now, I'm not an expert on tax law or estate law or any other kind of law, but what I understand is that the full brunt of estate taxes is back. So if people who own significant collections want to avoid or want their heirs to avoid having to give or pay a lot in taxes, this would seem to me is a very important thing to think about.
Well, I would recommend, yes, that they speak with a trust and estate attorney in anticipation of making these plans. But, to summarize, I think collectors still have the three choices, whether it be during lifetime or as part of their estate. And that would be the outright sale of the collection, which could be done through an auction house, dealers, or selling it to other collectors. But they will have to pay a capital gains tax,
right?
Which at the moment is still at 28%, unlike other assets, which are, as we know, at 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you add the state and local tax to it, the tax can get up to about 40%. So that's something to consider. The second choice would be what they refer to as a non-charitable beneficiary, which would include what we've been discussing, which would be the heirs.
Right.
And then the third choice, Harold, would be to donate it to a charitable organization, such as a museum or a university, a gallery.
Right.
And there are different ways in which that can be done. But, again, I would recommend that they have a conversation with an attorney who's experienced in these matters to put together the best plan to not only perpetuate the legacy that they would like to leave with their collection, but to also avoid the estate having to pay undue tax for that collection.
And I'm going to assume that there are lawyers who specialize in this kind of work?
Yes.
How can you find one?
Well, most trust and estate attorneys have worked with art, or what they refer to as tangible personal property, and we're talking about not just paintings, drawings, and prints, but includes such things as coins and stamps, a jewelry collection, watches, all types of timepieces, because they fall into that category, again, that they refer to as tangible personal property, and it can be treated much the same. And there are attorneys out there, and certainly we can help in recommending attorneys for those who have an interest.
And you sort of read my mind. I want to go back, though, to planning. So let's say that someone who owns an important collection knows that their heirs have no interest in perpetuating it, mm-hmm. have never participated in the hobby. It's those folks who really need to pay careful attention to this kind of planning.
Well, that's right, because you have those two important issues at play. Again, the integrity of the collection, that it be maintained, and at the same time you want to avoid the tax consequence of adding the value of the collection to the estate. For example, the collection that may have cost the collector, say, $500,000 over his lifetime together with his wife, it may now be worth $1 million.
Right.
And when one passes on, the value gets stepped up, meaning that it now is worth $1 million instead of $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that the value of the estate will be increased by that amount, and it may be subject to additional tax. And that's why, if you plan ahead, you can avoid this dilemma.
Yeah, and you know, speaking just for myself, I pay enough taxes already. I don't want me or anybody that comes after me to have to do more than what's really necessary.
Well, that's right, and you don't want the heirs also to be disappointed in having to pay that extra tax when it could have very easily been avoided.
And make decisions at what are likely a difficult personal time.
That's right. So it's best to, you know, to circle back again, to have this conversation so the family's in agreement as to how everyone will proceed.
Right, right. And one of the things, and I think it's worth repeating, that you said last week was that the disposal or disposition of collectible or tangible property, it's different than stock certificates or savings bonds or things like that?
Well, it is. It's just more complex to treat. But if you plan ahead and you work with professionals who have experience in this area, it is not very difficult at all. It can be handled very straightforwardly without having to pay unnecessary tax. And at the same time, keeping the legacy intact.
Yeah, that's a good word. So for people who might want to chat with you about this one-on-one, how can they get in touch with you?
I can be reached at L as in Larry, C as in Charles, Z as in Zebra, A-L-E, at AOL.com.
And thank you for this really important lesson for the folks who want the legacy of their collections to go on after they've left this life.
Well, it's my pleasure. I know that it is a complex issue, but I wanted to at least give some of the issues at play that collectors need to be mindful of when having to deal with the inevitabilities of life.
Did you ever play with Legos when you were a kid?
I didn't.
You didn't? Oh, well, you wrecked my tease for next week, but that's okay. We're going to talk to a guy in New Zealand who doesn't just collect Legos,
right?
But collects the figures. What did he call them? They're the figures that are people, the characters in Lego displays.
Right.
And not only collects them, but invented an entire lexicon to describe them, and is in a big dispute with other Lego figure collectors about the nomenclature for describing them. And that's going to be next week on the Collector Show.
And
now, I never played with them either, so.
Oh, okay.
So,
But the fact that you have these competing interests at play, each believing that they have the final word on definitions, is fascinating.
It's drama in the world of Lego figure collecting that we will plumb next week on the Collector's Show here on Web Talk Radio. And thanking my friend Larry Zale, I'm Harold Nickel. Come back next week.